Pullman, we're here first for petitioner.
Yes, please, court, Mr. Dial, present argument.
May it please the court. For the record, my name is Ray Guy. I'm with the Dallas firm of Jenkins and Gilchrist, and I represent the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The FDIC is, of course, before this court as the petitioner and is a party to this case in its corporate capacity as the liquidator of the failed First National Bank of Midland, Texas. This is a deficiency case. The FDIC foreclosed on some real property that secured the indebtedness of a company called Judico Enterprises, Incorporated. It then sued the guarantors, Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell, to recover the deficiency that remained after foreclosure. The district court granted summary judgment for the FDIC. The Court of Appeals reversed, and the FDIC therefore brought this application for writ of error. The decision below was remarkable in its solicitude for one set of the parties to a $500,000 business transaction. The court below made new law in the field of the duty of good faith and fair dealing without acknowledging that it was doing so, and without so much as nodding in the direction of this court's pronouncements in the area, English versus Fisher, Arnold versus National County Mutual, Aranda versus INA, and Mangus versus Guerra. The court also backed away from and implicitly overruled two of this court's pronouncements in the cases of Terrence Savings versus Lucky Homes and American Savings versus Music, once again without even citing those opinions. I know you've read the briefs and know you've discussed this case at conference, so I don't intend to recite all the facts of the case unless you have specific questions about the facts. Instead, I'll simply bring up facts as they relate to particular arguments. I also don't intend to reiterate the arguments made in the brief, once again, unless you care to hear particular ones. Absent some other intention by the court, my intention is to, first of all, that this is not the type of case, nor is it the type of relationship in which it's appropriate to imply a duty of good faith and fair dealing between the parties. Second, that even if you were to do so, there is simply no evidence in this case of a lack of good faith by the FDIC. The delay in foreclosing simply cannot constitute bad faith or lack of good faith. And then third and fourth, to the extent that there is time remaining, two points that were mentioned by the court below, supposedly granted in reversing, but were not discussed in the opinion. First of all, I intend to show that the impairment of collateral defense, which was raised in points of error 3 and 4 below by the appellants, is inapplicable in this case. And even if it were applicable, it's been waived permissibly by the guarantors. And then finally, once again, to the extent that there is time, to show that the seventh paragraph of the First National Bank guarantees does not preclude suit by the FDIC in its corporate capacity based strictly on some hypothetical remaining indebtedness at another bank. To date, this court has carefully chosen those relationships which it believes is appropriate for the imposition on one of the parties of an implied duty to deal in good faith with the other party. In each of those relationships, there has existed, as Justice Spears pointed out in his concurrence in English versus Fisher, an imbalance of bargaining power or something else implicit in the relationship that justified a relationship of trust and confidence between the parties. The obvious example is the insurance context, the Arnold case and the Aranda case, in which the insurer, over the course of time, is free to accept premiums on the policies, and then once a claim is made, is in a unique position to control the entire process and can deny a claim for a bad reason or no reason whatsoever, leave the insurer to flail away, file suit, get a judgment, and absent some kind of a tort duty, all the insurer has to do then is tender policy limits plus interest to satisfy the judgment. And in that situation, you have correctly held there must be some kind of a duty. There must be some kind of a tort violation for not complying with that duty, and there must be some kind of redress for the consumer or the workers' compensation insured who's at the mercy of the insurer at a time when it needs the claim to be paid or the disability benefits to be paid. And absent compliance with that duty, some remedy such as punitive damages to cure the conduct by the insurer. Similarly, in the case of the executive rights owner in an oil and gas mineral context, the Mangus versus Guerra case. All you have to do to see how that imposition of an implied duty is justified is read the facts as you recited them in Mangus versus Guerra. Clinton Mangus becomes essentially Exhibit A in support of the imposition of a duty on behalf of the non-executive working interest owners owed by the executive rights owner. This case is not either one of those cases. This case, as I said, involves a $500,000 business deal. Mr. Cohen and Mr. Powell wanted $460,000 to buy a piece of industrial property in Odessa, Texas. First National Bank of Midland had access to $460,000 of its depositors' money, which it could lend out upon appropriate conditions. The parties came together and agreed upon the terms by which the bank would part with its $460,000. And those terms included a guarantee by Mr. Coleman and a guarantee by Mr. Powell in which they granted the bank substantial rights should it become necessary to enforce the loan against them. If Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell had gone to five different banks in the Midland-Odessa area seeking their loan, I would imagine they would have found five different sets of terms on which those banks would have been willing to loan the money, if in fact they all would have been willing to part with the money. Perhaps each one of those loans would have required a guarantee. Perhaps even each one of those guarantees would have been similar in form to the one-page First National Bank standard form guarantee that they signed in this case. But it hardly seems unreasonable in the context of a loan such as this one. It hardly seems an abuse of economic power for a bank to specify very strict terms on which it's willing to part with $500,000 of its money, including a guarantee that allows the bank to pursue the guarantors without first resorting to collateral. This is simply not the type of case that requires the kind of solicitude for one party that's been shown by the court below. This case is also a prime example of what you sought to avoid when you decided English versus Fisher. You noted in that case that adopting this California generalized duty of good faith would result in, quoting here, abolishing our system of government according to settled rules of law, and let each case be decided upon by what seems fair and in good faith by each fact finder. In the fifth paragraph of their guarantees, Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell agreed that if the indebtedness were secured, the creditor could, at its discretion, with or without consideration, substitute collateral or release collateral, and if in fact there was a separate security agreement, they agreed that the exercise by the creditor, First National Bank of Midland, of any right conferred upon it in the agreement would be wholly discretionary, and the exercise or failure to exercise rights against the collateral would not result in any waiver of obligations by the guarantors. That's quoted in the application for writ of error at page 38. If you affirm the decision below so that there is imposed in this case a duty of good faith and fair dealing, and you allow that to overturn the summary deficiency judgment here, what that means is that in future cases involving a business deal between parties, where one of those parties is a bank, the court is supposed to ignore carefully drafted contractual language and hold that when you go to the fact finder in the case, you simply ask two questions. Does it appear to you that the bank was fair? If not, how much should it cost the bank? That's the result you sought to avoid in English versus Fisher, and that's the result that should not be countenanced in this case.
Don't you think, though, that Aranda and later cases have completely modified English versus Fisher and Judge Wallace's writing?
In the specific context that are involved in Aranda and Mangus and Arnold, Your Honor, I believe that is correct. It is certainly appropriate to look at transactions on a generic transaction-by-transaction basis and see which of those involve this imbalance of bargaining power or a need for reliance upon some duty of good faith. For example, I don't know what this court's going to do with McClendon versus Ingersoll Rand, but I can see where perhaps it's appropriate in that context where you have an at-will employment contract, regardless of what the rule has been in Texas in the past, where sometimes the employee is at the mercy of the employer. Maybe there's a graduated commission scale. And late in the year, when his commissions are high, the employer seeks to impose some change in the terms of employment so that the employee really has no realistic economic possibility but to stay with the job. Maybe under some circumstances there is a need for the imposition of a duty in that case. Clearly in the context of consumer insurance, clearly in the context of workers' compensation insurance, clearly in the context of the executive rights owner, there is a need to say, yes, there's going to be an implied duty. Apart from that, the other cases you mentioned in your concurrence in English versus Fisher talk primarily about fiduciary duties. And the law in Texas has always been that in addition to those cases where there's a clear fiduciary duty as a matter of law, attorney-client, agent-principal, for example, partnership, that in individualized cases you can find on the facts of a particular case.
Of course, English versus Fisher, the concurrence wasn't limited to those with a fiduciary duty. That's the reason I had to think up the term special relationship.
I
couldn't think of anything else.
I understand that. I believe the cases do say fiduciary duty, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is I believe that the opinion of this court might leave room for the fact that in a particular case, the relationship between banker and customer might justify saying the banker's a fiduciary here.
Here we have a summary judgment that's been granted against the plaintiff. And all the Court of Appeals has done is to reverse that and say there's a fact issue here. Let's get some kind of determination by a fact finder, and they'll be made determine whether there's a duty that exists. But the concept of determining a case based on whether or not there's duty, close quote, goes back to the 30s and 40s, and it really is not a viable theory anymore, except in those cases where, as a matter of law, there is no duty. But just to make a choice that there is no duty in a factual context, this court has pretty well abandoned that practice, haven't they?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, in the sense that in this case there was no attempt to show that whoever the banker was at First National Bank of Midland owed a particular duty based upon a particular relationship of advisor or whatever to Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell. I believe the court has clearly said that when you're looking at a relationship here, as the Court of Appeals below did, to decide whether a banker owes a duty of good faith to his customer, whether an employer at will owes a duty of good faith to the employee at will, you can say there are certain relationships that justify that duty. What the court below did was to stamp the banker-customer relationship with the special relationship tag, just the opposite of what the Amarillo court did in the Lovell case, where it said there is no special relationship. There is no duty of good faith owed by banker to borrower. There are a number of cases that say that in the typical banker-customer relationship, lender-borrower relationship, there is no fiduciary duty. Now, you might take a particular case and say that on these facts there may be, but there was no allegation below, no attempt to show by summary judgment evidence that this particular case had those hallmarks of a fiduciary relationship or special relationship or whatever. What they argued was banks owe a duty, therefore, by delaying and foreclosing, the bank violated that duty.
You accept the special relationship concept and Aranda and others. You're just simply saying that in this case there's no special relationship.
I think that I go further than that, Your Honor. I believe that between banker and customer there is no special relationship as a matter of law. I think that in specific banker-customer, borrower-lender relationships, there is room to say, to show me some facts of this case, and I may say the banker was a fiduciary. We had one a couple of months ago where there was a trial where there was an allegation that the banker was a fiduciary. And one of the things that we ate in that case was a letter that the banker wrote to the borrower who said, the banker said, I want to be considered not just the banker for ABC Industries, but I want to be considered a part of the management team. Well, the jury found fiduciary, and they probably should have in that case. There's not much.
You got his wife, didn't he?
You can't, those documents get back to haunt you. But in the cut, I think it is time to announce a rule that says, in the ordinary relationship between banker and borrower, this does not have those hallmarks. This is not insurer-insurer. This is not executive rights versus non-executive owner. This is a case where the general relationship doesn't justify the duty. I think it's also important to say that the court below, again, impliedly overruled this court's holdings in American Savings versus Music and Terrence Savings versus Lucky Homes. In the Terrence Savings case, you made three essential points. You held, first of all, that mere inadequacy of consideration does not render the foreclosure sale invalid, absent some indication that the sale was illegal or invalid. Secondly, you held that a mortgagee is perfectly right to buy in the property at foreclosure by bidding in part of the debt. And then third, if the sale is valid, then the deficiency is established by the bid price of foreclosure, the price at which the bank or S&L or whatever bought the property in, canceling part of the debt. And in the American Savings case, you went on to say that if you're going to attack a foreclosure sale, there must be some evidence of irregularity, though slight, which irregularity must have caused or contributed to cause the property to be sold for a grossly inadequate price.
Who is to determine that irregularity?
I think the trier of fact does that, Your Honor, again, in a particular case as it comes up.
And isn't that all the Court of Appeals held here, was that there was a fact question raised as to why it took the FDIC 21 months?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because American Savings and Terrence Savings and the decades-old cases on which they were based talked about how you conduct the sale. Did you fail to give notice? Did you go hide in some corner of the courthouse? Did you mislead the borrower as to when you were going to be there? Did you try to chill the bidding process? In that context, we're talking about the sale itself.
We're talking about the facts of those particular cases, weren't we?
There has never been a case that's held that anything other than the conduct of the sale on foreclosure day would allow you to attack the foreclosure process.
And does the date of foreclosure day become pertinent and become a fact question as to whether it was reasonable or not?
I don't see how it could, Your Honor, and that's the next step I would ask you to take. Assuming you want to reserve for another day the question of whether this is one of those special relationships, then I think you can say that on the facts of this case below, delay in foreclosing cannot constitute a bad faith. Delay in foreclosing cannot itself constitute an irregularity. The sole allegation here is that we were in a declining market and the bank didn't move promptly and the FDIC didn't move promptly to foreclose. What you're doing in that situation...
Well, it was calling their attention.
It's very questionable whether it was, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals opinion says that that letter of November the 16th of 1983 urges some action be taken. We quoted from that letter on page 20 of the application for writ of error. What that letter does is say, we'd like to meet with you concerning settlement. We think the property's worth the amount of the debt. Well, when borrowers talk about settlement, they don't talk about giving you the property and then letting you come after for a deficiency. They want to talk about wiping out the debt. There is no urging of prompt action. There is no, the property's declining in value, please capture the property now. The opinion below seems to assume that it's customary for debtors to want the process to go quickly. If that were true, you wouldn't see injunction suits being filed by the dozens on the first Monday of the month. The typical situation is the debtor doesn't want foreclosure to happen. The debtor files Chapter 11, as Judico did in this case. The debtor tries to slow the process down to get a bargaining position with the bank, or because the debtor thinks the debtor can sell the property better than the bank can.
Are all those fact questions or law questions?
I think you can say as a matter of law, Your Honor, that even if there is a duty of good faith, the delay in foreclosing, absent some evidence, which there does not exist in this case, that the banker was trying to make the property go down, mere delay in foreclosing is not anything less than good faith. There are too many things that can happen to cause the property value to go down. The logical corollary, or illogical, I guess I would say, is that if delay in foreclosing can be bad faith, then suppose the market's going up. Then is the bank going to be responsible for selling the property too quickly when there could have been more value caught 2 months down the road?
I revert to my original question. Is that a question of law or a question of fact to be determined by the circumstances of a particular case?
Where the only allegation, Your Honor, is that there was delay, where there is no credible evidence that would rise to a level that would say this is a lack of good faith, I think it's a question of law. I think you can say as a matter of law that simple delay in the foreclosure process, absent more, is not bad faith, is not an irregularity, and unless you're going to extend Tarrant Savings and American Savings and those other cases and say the conduct of the sale on foreclosure day is not all that matters, then I think you're going to have to make a new law, as the court below did without saying that was what it was doing.
Counsel, could not the debtor at any time simply go to the bank, pay off the debt, take title to the property, and then sell it at his discretion?
That's correct. There's been an amicus brief in this case that very ably pointed that out. The debtor didn't have to put the property into foreclosure. There's no indication of attempts by the debtor to negotiate with the bank, but the bank's not, if the bank has an appraisal that says the property's not worth the amount of the debt, the bank's not going to insist upon getting the full debt in order for the property to be sold. There are ample times for the debtor to go get the property out before foreclosure.
The debtor would have had it then. He could have waited 1 month or 1 year or 10 years to sell the property.
That's correct, and I believe if there had been any evidence of interest in the property, then the debtor would have been moving more promptly to get it sold. What happened was the debtor simply sat back and after the fact saw a chance to make new law, saw a chance to make the bank eat the fact that it took a while because of initially the fact that there was a bankruptcy file, then the fact that there was a failing bank trying to cover other bases, and then the fact that the FDIC suddenly came in and found itself involuntarily as a creditor of these people and thousands of others in Midland. There was simply no indication that the debtor did what it could have to get the property out. One further fact that you ought to know about, the FDIC sold this property in May of 1985. They had a bid, an appraisal rather, $390,000. It bid $357,000 at foreclosure and took the property for that amount. The FDIC sold the property 6 months later for $55,000. After netting out expenses of holding the property and paying taxes, the FDIC cleared about $43,000. What that says is that it doesn't matter so much what an appraisal says. When an appraiser says, if there is a willing buyer out there, he'll pay $390,000. The foreclosure sale is a public sale. At the foreclosure sale, there's room for people to come and bid. There's room for the debtors to come, stir up interest in the property, find alternative financing, get money in for a real bid as opposed to the bank simply canceling part of the debt. And if no one does that, what that probably means is that for a machine shop property in Odessa, Texas, in the oil economy, Nobody wants this property. And there may be no market. Or the market may be $55,000. And to the extent that you retreat from American Savings versus Music and Terrence Savings versus Lucky Home, you require people to begin depending upon appraisals to determine what was fair and reasonable. When all the debtors had to do is show up at the foreclosure sale, convince somebody the property's worth more than the bank's going to pay on it, get a real bid in, and therefore protect themselves as to the deficiency. Or, as Justice Cook has pointed out, do something to get the property sold before foreclosure. The time is not right to say that the debtor can sit back, make the bank be on penalty of not guessing which way the market's going to go, and then hold that the bank has violated good faith. The court below held that the bank knew, or the FDIC rather, knew the market was declining because it had appraisals over time, and each time an appraisal came in, the property value went down. That doesn't mean that the FDIC could predict where the property was going to go. Banker can't do that, developer can't do that, machine shop owner can't do that, no one can. That's a hindsight view. Will Rogers talked about something like that when he gave some investment advice. He said, if you want to make money, put all your savings into some good stock and hold it till it goes up and sell it. And if it don't go up, don't buy it. Well, that's what the court is holding the creditor in this case with doing, is predicting where it's going to go. Know if it's going to go up or down. Take your actions based upon your prediction of where the property is going to go, and if you don't move at the right speed based on how you predict the market and how we see it when in hindsight, therefore we're going to hold that you were in bad faith. For those reasons, Your Honor, I believe it's perfectly appropriate to say, first of all, that this is not a situation where you ought to stamp the relationship with the duty of good faith. And further, you ought to reaffirm the rule of American Savings versus Music and Terrence Savings versus Lucky Homes. Overrule the court's opinions below, for example, in the subsequent Olney Savings case, which the amicus brief also mentioned, and the cases in the Beaumont Court, such as Halter versus Allied Merchants Bank and Lee versus Sabine Bank, where the Beaumont Court has also stepped back from the Terrence Savings American Savings rule. Hold that what matters is how the foreclosure sale process was conducted on foreclosure day. And then absent some evidence of fiduciary relationship, which was never raised in this case, hold that the bank simply forecloses properly and that foreclosure sale price is what determines the deficiency. In that situation, you would reverse the judgment below, affirm the summary judgment granted for the FDIC and the district court level, and keep the rule intact for future generations until someone shows that there is a reason to hold otherwise. The time has expired. I will say the rest of the vote.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from the respondents.
Yes, thank you for Mr. Paxton is an argument to respond.
May it please the court, my name is Kurt Paxton. I'm from El Paso, Texas. The FDIC is indeed flexible before this court today. First, they argue there is no duty of good faith. Then they say if there was a duty, it was waived. Then they say if the duty wasn't waived, it wasn't breached. Let's go back to the trial court and look at the summary judgment that this court is reviewing today. Their brief attempts to try this case in this court. Their motion for summary judgment has two affidavits attached to it. One by a custodian of record saying, here's the note, and by my calculation, here's the amount due. And then there's an attorney's affidavit as to attorney's fees. We controverted that, and they non-suited on attorney's fees. There's no jury trial whatsoever on any issue. The one thing they didn't try and do is prove good faith. They simply relied on the fact that they were going to argue to every court that heard this case that there was no duty of good faith until they got to this court. And now in their brief, they want to convince you that even if there is a duty of good faith, by God, they complied with it. That they showed good faith to Willie Coleman and Dwayne Powell and how they handled this collateral that they had guaranteed the debt for. They also didn't allege this application of federal common law. We didn't hear about that at the trial court. We never heard about that at the Court of Appeals. This court said you can waive sovereign immunity. By God, you can waive application of federal common law, too. So there was no request for that judicial notice. They wanted to prove up Utah law or Montana law or federal common law. There's a process for that in the Texas Rules of Evidence. You come in and you say, Judge, here's the law that needs to be applied in this case, and it's a question of law upon review, like all other questions of law. There's no attempt to do that.
Counsel, is it your position that the breach of good faith and fair dealing is one that calls for the imposition of tort or contract remedies?
Judge, that's something that I hope this court would flesh out for me. In this case, all I'm asking for is the same type of remedy I'd receive if there was an irregularity in the trustee's sale. All I want to do is be credited for the amount of their appraisal that existed at the time that under their manual, they should have had a foreclosure sale. I'm not looking to gain anything from the FDIC or the First National Bank at Midland. All I'm asking for is fair credit on that debt as it existed when they should have foreclosed under their own manual for commercial loans. So that's the remedy we seek.
Do you acknowledge that appraisals in today's economy, by the way, was this business in the oil-related business?
Yes, sir, it was.
Okay. Was there a recession in that city in the oil business?
Absolutely. Well documented.
Would you acknowledge that not all appraisals were up to snuff? In other words, that they could not bring what they were appraised for?
This one would. Judico was in bankruptcy. Durrett rule, be it good or bad, it's the rule that we have in the bankruptcy court. It's the real world, says they had to bid in 70% of the fair market value. That's the real world. They had no room to wiggle. Judico Enterprises had filed for bankruptcy in the Western District of Texas. And so that's all we're asking for, is just 70% of their own appraisal. And yes, they would have had to pay that in. You know, they always like to show up and say, well, you're just lucky we bid it in for $357,000. The shoeshine man could have had it for a dollar. But that's not true. In this case, if we can get it to a jury, we can show that they, by their own admission, had to pay in at least 70%. They had a minimum and a maximum protective bid, and we went over that in the deposition. And so that's sort of that's cemented and solid for us. The chronology is, in October 14, 1983, they took over this bank. 1 month later, and again, you can read that letter a bunch of different ways, but what it says is, please move the property. 1 month later, after they took over this bank, there were no problems in terms of getting this thing out of the bankruptcy court. That's why we brought forward the bankruptcy filings that show that, if anything, we were more than happy to help them. Everything was agreed.
Mr. Baxter, can you cite language in that letter that states, please move the property? What specifically in that letter are you referring to when you say you make the representation that it can be read and you read it that way?
Judge Gonzalez, it's because we informed them that the property was worth.
Do you have a letter there? What language do you want me to look at?
The exact same language that Mr. Guy quoted.
Well, but he doesn't read it that way. Do we have a copy?
There was a debt. The FDIC had two things to look to. They had to look to the collateral, and they had guarantees, and then they had a claim in the bankruptcy court. In looking at that and how they're going to recover on that, we said the value of the property is worth the amount of the debt. In other words, at that point in time, it would create very little of any deficiency, because they would have had to pay in 70%. It wasn't until June 7 of 85 that they finally did have a foreclosure sale for this property. And this is what's important. Again and again, they say that it's just simple delay in foreclosure without more doesn't implicate any good faith duty. We have that without more in this case.
Mr. Paxton, excuse me for interrupting. I have a letter in front of me. It's in page 20. It's counsel states in the petition's application for writ of error. This letter speaks about a meeting to be held, and you expressed a desire to have a meeting. I don't really find anything in here where you're asking them to please move on the sale. Can you read it any different?
Judge, I think the letter speaks for itself, and again, rather than get into the wording of that letter, I think it at least creates a fact issue in which we can get the people, Mr. Stedman from the FDIC, we can get the attorney who wrote that letter as the outcome of that meeting, and show that the intent and the import was to get the property sold to credit the collateral to the indebtedness. And so, I mean, that's something that we can develop before a jury, and the jury will hear sworn testimony on that. But again, in this case, we have that without more that he talked about. They violated their own commercial and other loans manual. The FDIC promulgates these rules for application in all 50 states. For some reason, the Midland Division Office violates that with respect to the Coleman Powell loan. I think that is something that raises the specter of bad faith. And again, they talk about, well, this hindsight and this Will Rogers sage advice and so forth. In the deposition, it wasn't like, well, we sort of guessed that maybe this was going to happen. They knew it was happening. They had specific appraisals showing that this property was going down in value. They knew that Ector County had a decline because the oil market was going under. And so it wasn't like, well, gosh, we guessed and we guessed wrong. They knew exactly what was happening. This was deliberate and conscious. And I think we ought to be able to approach a jury on that.
Also, considering that you're compliance with the guarantors, why didn't they simply go in, pay off the debt, and take title to the property, and then dispose of it at their own leisure?
Judge, again, in the real world, one of the reasons that people default on their mortgage loans is because they don't have the money to make the monthly installment. I can't pay my 30-year mortgage off today. I don't have that kind of money. I'd have to find somebody else that would loan me that money, but if I'm in default on one loan, they don't even want me coming in the door. That's right. They could have taken $300,000 and gone in there and exercised their right of subrogation and sold it themselves in a hypothetical, mythical world. This case affects every homeowner in the state of Texas that has a mortgage on their house.
Didn't the guarantee by its very effect and specific wording say that they waived and the bank did not have to proceed against the property? They could proceed directly against the guarantor?
Judge, that's exactly right. We make no complaint about that. We make no complaint. They sued us, and that's just the order of sale. They could sue the guarantor before they sell the property. That's not the problem. And again, we're saying that they can exercise their contractual rights under that. We know that they have the power of sale. We know that they can call on the trustee to go out there and strike it off on the first Tuesday of the month. Just like under Aranda, those companies could go ahead and contest who had the coverage and who the subscriber was for that employee. Again, we're not saying it was illegal. We're saying it was pretty darn irregular. Okay? And an irregularity is what gets us there. Just like in Aranda, those workers' compensation carriers did not violate the workers' compensation statute. This court says, as you work within the parameters of that workers' compensation statute and how you exercise your contractual and statutory duty, we're going to allow a jury to take a look at that because you're exercising bad faith and need to be punished for it.
There was default, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. Who took Chapter 11, the bank or the debtor?
Judico Enterprises is the company that my client stood behind, and they took bankruptcy.
Well, your clients owned the company, did they not?
They were stockholders, yes, sir.
Were they the majority stockholders?
I believe so.
Okay. How long was taken up by the bankruptcy? How much of the delay is attributable to the bankruptcy, in your opinion?
Almost none. I mean, again, we brought forward the bankruptcy documents that show that at a very early date, even before the FDIC took over the bank, we were trying to push this property out of the bankruptcy and get it sold at foreclosure sale.
Did you ever file a motion to abandon the property to the bank?
Yes, sir. I think there was a motion to abandon. And the order that the FDIC finally took was an agreed order. So the delay in this case...
Did you file a motion to abandon was my question.
Judge, again, I think that we did, and I think it's in the transcript. I was not the bankruptcy lawyer for these clients, but at the same time, there was a motion to abandon. I think it was made while the bank still had the asset. The FDIC, I want to say, never followed up on that when they took over the property. But again, the chronology of the bankruptcy proceedings are documented in the transcript in this case.
Is not the very effect of filing bankruptcy delayed?
Not necessarily.
Were there any significant assets other than the real property?
As far as accounts receivables and things like that, I don't know. I didn't handle the bankruptcy proceeding.
Counsel, what bothers me in this case is that when you get a declining market, and there may in fact be no buyers out there, you want to impose upon the bank the duty of good faith and fair dealing in disposing of the property at the time when it would cause you the least harm. What would you say if the market was going up and the bank saw a chance to make some money, and so they foreclosed the first time you missed the first payment, and you'd be in here saying, well, gee, if you'd waited another 6 months, we could have sold the property for profit, and we could have paid you off, and we would have never lost our business.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And for instance, one of the well-recognized duties of good faith is that you have to use good faith in accelerating a note. For instance, if you have a bank and all of a sudden it finds out, well, we've got a bunch of these old 6% notes out there, you know, start clocking these things in at 12 noon. They come into 1201, they're in default, and accelerate them. I don't want any more 6% loans here after Friday. You could do that. You should be exercising some awful bad faith. And I think a jury ought to be able to take a look at that bad faith. And again, they might be exercising their contractual duties, and maybe the little card that you signed, the signature card, said 1201 is the time they're going to date stamp these things in here, but it's awful bad faith. And again, I think a jury ought to be able to take a look at it. And so again, we're dealing with individual fact patterns, but as a matter of law, is there any reason that a bank, in exercising its self-help remedies, shouldn't be at least subject to a duty of good faith? UCC says so.
Counsel, will you define
good faith farming, which definition you're using, since there are numerous ones, at least several under the UCC and also several others quoted in the case law.
In this case, I used the most conservative one I could find, and that's the one that's supplied by the UCC. I submitted my special issues and definitions, and I actually thought I was going to have a chance to try this case. Honesty in fact, or transaction. That's the one supplied by the UCC. The legislature wrote that and gave it to us. I'm willing to even take that to a jury, although I wish the court would give us a better handle on what that means and give us a better definition of good faith that we can use in the trial court. Restatement of contracts. Aranda doesn't say just insurance contracts. Aranda says in every contract there's a duty of good faith, and then it found a contract between the carrier and the claimant. It cited the Montgomery Ward case, which was every contract. UCC says every contract. Restatement of a contract. Section 205 says every contract. We've got a contract. FDIC absolutely ignores the UCC. They just want to tear that page out of the book. The UCC says you can't waive the duty of good faith under any circumstances. No matter how egregious an adhesion contract you sign at that bank, you just can't walk away from the duty of good faith.
Excuse me, counsel. You're saying that the contract, your clients, was a contract of adhesion? That your clients were forced involuntarily against their own will to sign that contract at the bank?
Judge, in the real world, if you scratch one thing off on one of those loan documents, that's a walk away.
Okay, but you had the right to walk away and go to a bank of your choosing, didn't you?
That's exactly right. But Judge, let's talk about, when we talk about this special relationship and the duty of good faith, it's the imbalance of bargaining power that's one of the main things that this court has spoken about. In this situation, it's true that at the time they first made the loan, there was any number of banks that might have made us that loan. Just like when you go out and buy a policy of automobile insurance, everybody in the phone book might could sell you a policy of insurance if your record isn't too, you know, bloody awful. The imbalance of bargaining power occurs at a later time. In an insurance context, it occurs when there's been a loss, not when you bought the policy. In the lender-debtor relationship, it occurs when there's been a default, not at the time you took out the loan.
How long had they been dealing with this particular bank?
Judge, again, I don't know.
A bank might loan you money if you're a good customer at prime, or they might loan you prime plus one, prime plus two, or even floating prime. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I assume that if they chose this bank, it was their choice.
Yes, sir. No one held a gun to our head when we signed these documents. And we're not saying that there was any fraud or duress or mistake in terms of signing these documents, but the point is that regardless of that, you might differ for an interest rate, but I don't think you can scratch anything out on that loan document and have a loan. You got a bunch of assistant vice presidents that don't have authority to do that. They take it from their lawyer, and that's the form they use, and it's understandable because they've got a couple thousand loans and they can't have individual relationships with every single, you know, debtor. And so that's why they use the form and they insist on the form, and if you don't sign it, it is a walk away and it is an adhesion contract. Yes, sir, it is.
Well, wouldn't that depend upon the financial strength of the borrower? If the borrower was very financially sound, if they had substantial assets, wouldn't that not allow them to negotiate with the bank on the terms of the guarantee?
Possibly IBM, but with respect to people like us, I'm saying you might be able to get a better interest rate, how close to prime you're going to get, but again, I don't think you can dicker on the terms and the terms of a guarantee in terms of what their rights are in the fault. I really don't think you can do that, no sir. I don't think they'd allow you to. But again, we're dealing with matters that if they want to argue that to a jury, that we consciously waive this duty of good faith, that's fine. But again, there is a duty of good faith, and I think that is what this court needs to decide and bring forward. The other thing is, and it's interesting because Mr. Guy talked about that case where the FDIC or the bank wrote an unfortunate letter about being part of the management team. If you go through the FDIC deposition of that one account officer who was handling this account, in my deposition I asked him, do you recognize you had a fiduciary obligation? He did say yes, and in a post-trial submission to this court, I will bring forward that deposition testimony. You'll see that the FDIC account officer felt he did have a fiduciary obligation. So again, he said that was a horse of a different color. Maybe that's what we have here today in this case.
Counsel, you're with the Fine Fire. Let me ask you this. Do y'all deal regularly with one bank? Your firm?
Yes, sir.
Are you a PC or a partnership?
It's a PC now.
Okay. Do the partners have to sign individual guarantees to the PC note at the bank?
No, sir. That's one of the things that we were able to slip out of.
You were able to slip out of it.
We just went from a partnership to a PC, and that's one of the nice things about it is they were able to get off the individual guarantees and individual liability.
So you were able to strike one of the standard terms.
Well, just this one. But again, even though we were the lawyers at Texas Commerce Bank El Paso, I don't think they would allow the individual partners to scratch out different parts of that guarantee. I think that, you know, you sign it, and you sign on the bottom and only the bottom.
Well, you get out of the most important.
That's right. As far as what this court is presented with today, in my response to the motion for a hearing of the Court of Appeals, I cite a Houston Law Review article. And in that, the commentator talks about the duty of good faith is recognized in lender liability situations. But he draws a conservative stripe. And he says this court is not going to create new and different duties under the loan by imposition of a good faith duty. For instance, you don't have some kind of supplementary notice before a foreclosure sale because of the duty of good faith. He says it's only in terms of looking at the contract and the four corners of that contract and how people exercise their rights within that contract will a duty of good faith be inquired about. And again, I think that meshes exactly with the Ronda, where we didn't have a violation of the comp statute. We are looking at how someone exercised their statutory and contractual rights and remedies under the compensation statute. And again, I'm not asking this court to throw open the gate. Every deficiency suit does not mean there was bad faith. Just like every workers' compensation case in which the comp carrier filed a general denial answer on the suit to set aside is not a bad faith lawsuit. I don't have any qualms with the NRE given to this court to the Lovell versus Western National Life case, that of the Amarillo Court of Appeals. I think it's a joke that just because you had a substitute trustee come in, somehow that's bad faith and a producing cause of damages to you. Those aren't our facts. We have egregious facts here. This was conscious and knowing decline in the market, violation of the FDIC's own policies and procedures, and they knew about it from the get-go. From the very start, their account officer knew what was going to happen to this property and allowed it to happen because they knew that in all likelihood they were going to have to pay 70%. And if they could minimize that 70% and bid in at their bargain auction, they still had two substantial people on the hook, on a guarantee that they could recover from. And so I'm saying it was their strategy from the very start to try and maximize the deficiency as to Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell, because they weren't going to do so well, and they didn't, as he said, speaking outside the records, they only got $55,000 for the property. Again, I think it goes to show the deliberateness of their action in this case. Again, this case affects every homeowner and landowner in the state of Texas. Article 9 would protect us if we had personal property, but we know with regard to real estate, Article 9 is inapplicable. It seems to me that why would we have these protections under Article 9 for personal property when the largest investment that most people make in their life is their home, is their land investment? Why then is this standard of scrutiny and duty of commercial reason was lowered to the floor that if you just have technical, formal compliance with the property code in terms of between 10 and 4 on the first Tuesday of the month will immunize your action in terms of how you produce that result. So again, I think the scope needs to be broader and the duty of good faith needs to be there to protect us all. And again, I just don't think there's any reason why banks shouldn't be subjected to a good faith duty in how they exercise their self-help remedies. Impairment of collateral, setting aside the good faith issues. Article 3606 says an impairment of collateral is available to any party to the instrument. In Crimmins versus Lowry, this case held that as long as you have this right of subrogation, you have a right of recourse, and that would entitle you to claim the suretyship defenses of Article 3606. We didn't sign in our individual capacities on that note, but the guarantee doesn't exist in a vacuum. It goes along with something. It travels in the same little packet at the bank, and it goes with the note. And that note is an instrument. And that guarantee attached to it, the same as if they had typed on the bottom, guarantee, and we subscribed our names and dated it. To the same effect. It just happened to be a separate piece of paper. And again, I think that the comments to Article 3606 expressly contemplate that anyone who is secondarily liable, anyone standing in the shoes of a surety, will be afforded this right to complain about impairment of collateral.
if there is no Article 3606 defenses, the UCC only takes over that part of the common law that it supersedes. And unsuperseded common law has survived. I found some old cases that say that impairment of collateral will not be allowed under Texas law. And so I'll take it either which way. But either which way, I have an impairment of collateral defense that I'm entitled to approach a jury on. They're not entitled to a summary judgment. Again, all they had was some custodian of records affidavit. They never negatived the idea that they did impair the collateral. I'll go ahead and sum up. The FDIC knowingly and consciously wasted the collateral in this case, violating their own federally mandated guidelines. Where there's a wrong, there's a remedy. We finally pray that this court affirm the Court of Appeals judgment in all respects.
Thank you, Counsel. Rebuttal?
May it please the Court, I do have several comments with respect to rebuttal. First of all, Mr. Paxton talked about the jury at 70%. Well, that's an entirely different rule that deals with the concept of preferences in bankruptcy. There's some doubt as to whether the jury at standard really applies. The FDIC has given itself a much more rigorous standard, typically bids in 85%. Why they picked 91% in this case, I'm not sure, but we did bid more than 70%. Mr. Paxton says all they want is their 70%.
If you take the highest appraisal that's mentioned in that interrogatory answer, $568,000, multiplied times 70%, what you come out with is a bid price of $397,000. So you come out with about a $50,000 difference in the deficiency. I don't think we're going to see the math that we've got for a deficiency now. So if that's all his complaint is, I don't think it would have any real effect on this case. With respect to the letter that was written in November of 1983,
is that what he was questioning? In our individual capacities on that note. But the guarantee doesn't exist in a vacuum. It goes along with something. It travels in the same little packet at the bank, and it goes with the note. And that note is an instrument. And that guarantee attached to it, the same as if they had typed on the bottom, guaranteed, and we subscribed our names and dated it. To the same effect. It just happened to be a separate piece of paper. And again, I think that the comments to Article 3606 expressly contemplate that anyone who is secondarily liable, anyone standing in the shoes of a surety, will be afforded this right to complain about impairment of collateral. If there is no Article 3606 defenses, the UCC only takes over that part of the common law that it supersedes. And unsuperseded common law has survived. I found some old cases that say that impairment of collateral will not be allowed under Texas law. And so I'll take it either which way. But either which way, I have an impairment of collateral defense that I'm entitled to approach a jury on. They're not entitled to a summary judgment. Again, all they had was some custodian of records affidavit. They never negatived the idea that they did impair the collateral. I'll go ahead and sum up. The FDIC knowingly and consciously wasted the collateral in this case, violating their own federally mandated guidelines. Where there's a wrong, there's a remedy. We finally pray that this court affirm the Court of Appeals judgment in all respects.
Thank you, Counsel. Rebuttal?
May it please the Court, I do have several comments with respect to rebuttal. First of all, Mr. Paxton talked about the jury at 70%. Well, that's an entirely different rule that deals with the concept of preferences in bankruptcy. There's some doubt as to whether the jury at standard really applies. The FDIC has given itself a much more rigorous standard, typically bids in 85%. Why they picked 91% in this case, I'm not sure, but we did bid more than 70%. Mr. Paxton says all they want is 70%. If you take the highest appraisal that's mentioned in that
in that interrogatory answer, $568,000, multiplied times 7%, what you come out with is a bid price of $397,000. So you come out with about a $50,000 difference in the deficiency. I don't think we're going to see the math that we've got for a deficiency now. So if that's all his complaint is, I don't think it would have any real effect on this case. With respect to the letter that was written in November of 1983, Mr. Paxton says what he wants is just something he can get before a jury. As I believe Justice Gonzalez's questions pointed out, the letter doesn't raise what the Court of Appeals below said it raised. And summary judgment is designed to take away cases where you simply want to get to a jury if you've taken your best shot at raising a fact issue and you haven't done so. And that's why summary judgment was appropriate in this case. There was, as best I understand it, no motion to abandon by the debtor or by the trustee in this case. The motion that Mr. Paxton was referring to occurred in June or July of 1983 before the bank failed. The bank had to pass that motion because of the lack of an available witness. And then the bank failed in October, and it's like triage from then on. You try to see who on the battlefield is most able to be helped. And foreclosing on a piece of property in Odessa must not have gotten their attention again. But when the bank had to pass the hearing, when the bank said, we don't have our witness here on our motion to lift the stay, the debtor did not come back in and say, wait a minute, you don't need a hearing. We agree that this property is not worth the amount of the debt. You've got it over, you're undersecured, you can take the property out, we're not going to do business anymore. All you have to do in that situation is voluntarily abandon the property. And unless someone else can show there's an excess of value, the property comes out. The debtor didn't do that. What Judico, Mr. Coleman, and Powell did was simply wait back and let the FDIC come in and take over the bank and then try to find some grounds later on to get out from under. At any stage in the proceedings, the debtor could have voluntarily abandoned the property much more readily than even a secured creditor could do. With respect to the manual for commercial loans, there is no indication that that manual prescribed the protection for the debtors. The manual simply said that absent other considerations, it's appropriate to wait 4 months after default before you foreclose. You can read that as saying that you don't want to rush in willy-nilly at the first default, 12:01 p.m. or whatever, as Mr. Paxton says, and foreclose. It also says unusual circumstances may change things. I don't know precisely the reasons why it took so long. I don't know why the bank didn't move more promptly, but I do know that with the OCC coming in, looking at loans, trying to decide whether this bank was insolvent, there wasn't time to do everything the bankers wanted to do. Once the bank failed and the FDIC came in, the FDIC went, as I said in my brief, from having no presence in Midland, Odessa, to immediately becoming the third largest employer on a $1.5 billion bank, at that time the second largest bank failure ever in the country, behind only Franklin National Bank. You're holding the FDIC to bad faith if you affirm the court below when all that happened was they didn't move as promptly as somebody else would have liked for them to move in hindsight when that somebody else wasn't making the move himself.
You point out the very obvious, and that is we really don't know what happened, do we?
That's correct. That's correct. No one knows exactly. I can certainly...
And wouldn't know without a trial, would we?
That's correct. But unless you hold that delay itself can constitute bad faith, and unless you hold that there is a duty of good faith implied in this case, it doesn't matter. Because all we have is the delay. There were repeated attempts below to try to come up with some kind of bad motive, repeated attempts to say, well, you already had too much ORE property and you didn't want to pay more, you wanted the property to go down, and repeatedly the FDIC officer said that wasn't our motivation. We were simply trying to get around to doing things and there was no bad faith. We're not going to know the reason, but I think the reason is irrelevant at this time.
It was so refreshing to see the El Paso court hold there was a fact issue in one of these cases. It just burst my bubble.
I guess it depends upon which side you're on. I didn't feel refreshed back in November. Mr. Paxton mentions that this case affects every homeowner in Texas. That's an important consideration because I think what's going to happen here is if you do limit the process, if you make the remedy of nonjudicial foreclosure more difficult to go through, you're going to compel people to go to other means. I have been at seminars where bank counsel has said that until this case is resolved, we're going to recommend that you judicially foreclose, sue the debtor for judicial foreclosure. In Bayer County, for the first 4 months of the year, there have been approximately 400 residential foreclosures per month and about 35 commercial ones. In Travis County thus far, about 350 residential per month and about 20 commercial ones.
take all those cases, convert them to judicial foreclosures, put them on the dockets of the court below, and you're going to see a real erosion of what's been a very efficient, very good procedure in Texas, a laudatory procedure for foreclosing without clogging up the courts. And you're taking away that remedy if you put the creditor on the kind of choices that the court below did. With respect to the Aranda citation, the Aranda case did not hold as a duty of good faith in every context. It simply affirmed the old Montgomery Ward versus Scharenbeck rule. It said that if you agree to perform some obligation, you must do it with reasonable faithfulness. Read through that guarantee. The bank didn't owe any obligation to Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell. The bank parted with $460,000. Its obligations were finished at that time, except for complying with the law. And there was no duty to be performed owed to those people with reasonable expedience and faithfulness. With respect to insurance policies, Mr. Paxton said he could go to other insurance companies and get the same kinds of terms. The clear difference is everyone perceives a need for insurance. And I'm going to take an insurance policy even if it begins to look like a receipt for premiums plus a disclaimer, because I think I need insurance. Not everyone needs $460,000 or wants $460,000. The remedy was to walk away. Try to find different terms somewhere else, but you don't have to take the money if you don't want to abide by the terms. The FDIC has not ignored the UCC in this case. As the amicus brief, I think, has carefully pointed out, Article 1 of the UCC doesn't apply to transactions of this nature. And even if you do apply the 1203 obligation of good faith under the UCC, once again, there simply was no duty owed to the debtors in this case. But once you do agree to do something, the UCC, if it applies, says you do that thing with good faith. But where the contract says we've completed our obligations and we have now negotiated at the time of default when we are already out $500,000 so that we can proceed according to our own options, then the duty of good faith doesn't apply because there is no obligation owed except to try to get the money back as best you can. And the obligation is to your depositors and your shareholders and later on the FDIC to its commercial insurance fund. In English versus Fisher, you said that if you adopted the laudatory duty of good faith, you would place a party under the onerous threat of treble damages should he seek to compel his adversary to perform according to the contract terms as agreed upon by the parties. The FDIC complied with contract terms. The only party that has not done so is Mr. Coleman and Mr. Powell. There may well have been bad faith in this case. But bad faith may well consist of signing a document that says you can release collateral if you want to, I'll pay whether you get anything for the collateral, and then tying up the process by attacking what was done with the collateral, even trying to impugn the integrity of account officers who are just trying to do the best job they can to collect. There may have been bad faith in this case. It certainly wasn't on the part of the FDIC or the bank. Your Honor, for these reasons, we would respectfully pray that the judgment below be reversed, the summary judgment be affirmed in favor of the FDIC.
We thank all counsel. We'll take a brief recess.
Johnny, please rise.